This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Hello. Do you use the Stop It line? Do you know what I'm talking about? It's the number you can text if you're on public transport and you want to report antisocial behaviour and sexual offending. Have you got the Stop It number in your phone? Have you used it? I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour. And I will admit, I did not know about the Stop It line. I take public transport just about every single day. So if I don't know about it, is that a problem with me? Maybe I'm just not observant enough. Already on texts, I'm getting, yes, it is often. There are messages on the trains. I do use headphones, so maybe I've missed it through that. Have you used the Stop It line, and has it worked for you? It's clearly done some good, a lot of good. The text lines led to 77 arrests since it was launched 4 years ago. But I'm asking you, have you used it? If so, what did you think? And is it enough? Obviously, the police are saying it's not the only thing that they're doing that is going to be helping with safety on public transport. But does it make you feel safer, knowing about that text line? I'd love to know. And what else you think we should be doing to make public transport safer? How safe do you feel with that Stop It line? Also, how do you make connections later in life? Is it through clubs? Is it through volunteering? I'd love to hear your stories. 1300 222 774. The reason why we're touching on this is a couple of reasons, actually. We're going to look at a new program that's linking international students with older people in Melbourne, because both groups are prone to isolation and loneliness. We'll hear a little bit about how that is happening and how that's going. It was piloted last year and now it's got another couple of years. Do we have enough ways like that to connect as we get older? Maybe volunteering is the answer, and that's the second reason. It's National Volunteers Week. Tell me your volunteering stories. Nearly 10 million of us volunteered last year. 10 million. Either in formal or informal ways. Are you a volunteer? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. What does it do for you to be a volunteer? Is that the connection that you went into it for? Or is it something that's happened out of another motivation to get you out volunteering? Tell me how you connect in later life and your volunteer stories. Also this hour, you might have seen that story about the plane passenger who allegedly bit a flight attendant. Yikes, we look at the role of the captains when passengers get unruly, and maybe you've got stories about that yourself. And also, how worried should we be about the Ebola outbreak that's just been declared and in an international emergency? That's all coming up this hour. But first, have you used the Stop It text line? So joining me now is Mark Zervis, who is Transit Safety Division Superintendent, to tell us all, if we didn't know, about the Stop It text line. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mary. It's great to be here, and I'm sure that you're aware that the Stop It service, as you mentioned, was launched in 2022. Mm-hmm. What we found was that there was a murder of an international student prior to 2019 at Bundoora after she recently got off a tram. So we undertook research and we identified that over 95% of unwanted sexual behaviour is not reported by the public to police. So that was alarming for us. So we undertook work with the Department of Transport and Planning and our public transport operators to design a system that enabled non-urgent unwanted sexual behaviour and antisocial behaviour on public transport to be reported by the public. So it was the first of its kind in Australia, and it enables people to discreetly make notifications via that text service. Now, what we actually find is that almost half of the people who are making the notifications are bystanders, not necessarily a victim of antisocial behaviour.
Oh, that's really interesting. What's the theory behind that?
So, well, we've always encouraged bystanders to make the notifications. And as you can see, that the younger population, particularly females who are aged between 16 and 34, don't necessarily want to walk into a police station or ring 000. They often go home after the incidents occurred, discuss it with their family and friends, and we're receiving a lot of notifications
afterwards,
after they get home.
And just to reiterate to people, this is a text line, a dedicated text line. It is not a trigger for live action. Police aren't going to be coming out straight away to help you in any situation.
No, no. The text service actually tells you if it's an urgent matter to ring 000. It's a non-urgent notification service that enables both bystanders and victims to report behaviour.
And I would love to hear from people. And in response, obviously, to the questions about what that stop it number is, and I'll repeat this later too, it's 0499 455 455. That's 0499 455 455. Mark Zervis is with us. He is from the Transit Safety Division and is a superintendent. Mark, I opened by saying I didn't know about it. And, you know, I'm a data point of one, and maybe that just means that I'm not observant. There are certainly people who are saying on text, look, I see them on posters. I do hear messages on the train. But what do you believe about the awareness of this line? If I've got my headphones on and I'm not going past a poster, how do I find out about it?
There is marketing being undertaken at the moment through the Department of Transport Passenger Safety Campaign. So that is being undertaken both in posters, to cold LGBTQI plus groups via radio, etc. So we do really encourage the operators, public transport operators, to also do the on-air announcements, and they're quite frequent.
What about for the people like myself who have their headphones on, aren't listening to those announcements? Should there be ads, more numbers plastered around through public transport?
We do have the posters at each railway station, and we also have them on trams and buses.
Should so they be inside so that people can see them right when they need them?
They are, I believe they are on trams and some buses, but from a cost point of view, we certainly, we're working through the future with the Department of Transport and Planning.
Mm. You mentioned there a couple of groups who you believe aren't calling often enough.
Yes, the cold community. And also,
so culturally and linguistically diverse.
Correct. Yep. So the service is actually available in 12 languages, including English, such as Chinese, Vietnamese, Arabic, Cantonese, Korean, Khmer, Persian, Dari, Thai, Karen, Turkish, and Punjabi. They're the 12 most frequent cold communities that use public transport. Mm. So we're encouraging those commuters, if they see unwanted sexual behaviour or antisocial behaviour, to report through to the service.
Mm. Mark, I'll just feed back to you the flavour of some of these texts that I'm getting in. What's the point of it? Because it's not in real time. What is the point if there isn't instant action? What would you have to say to those people?
So the service is definitely not immediate response. We encourage the users on the system, if they need immediate police attention, to ring 000. And the service, when people use the service, it directs them to 000 should it be urgent. From a point of view of the service, we find that it identifies patterns of behaviour by certain people. And the CCTV system that is across public transports enables us to identify and respond to particular perpetrators, but also to identify hotspot locations that we can work with our public transport operators to respond to those locations.
Yeah, one tool in the toolbox, not the whole toolbox is what you're saying.
Correct, yes.
Yep. Mark Zervis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Matt.
Yeah, Mark Zervis is a superintendent with the Transit Safety Division, and I'll just repeat the stop it line as well, 0499 455 455, if you want to put it in your phone so you can learn, like me, what the options are out there. Also, to talk about safety on public transport a little more widely, I'm joined now by Dr. Romana Sarka, who's a research fellow at Monash University, looking into the transport research group work there. Thanks for joining us, Romana.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
What do you believe is what do you believe is the effect and effectiveness of the Stop It text line?
So we recently did a study with women rail users in Melbourne. It was around 500 sample that we got. And we asked about Stop It, actually, what you mentioned about the awareness and if they have ever used it or not. So what we found that only 2.3% of the sample have used it.
How many did you say?
2.3. So it's very like negligible, I would say, that the portion of women have used it. However, 68% of them were aware of it. But the rest of them, they have never heard of Stop It before. So it's around 32%.
Right. So a third of women in particular haven't heard of it before.
No.
And 2% are using it. Are they 2% of the people who have been exposed to that behaviour, or is it 2% of people overall?
No, so it's 2% of behaviour who have experienced harassment, and then they actually use that reporting service because it's a non-urgent service. What we found out from our result that having a service like Stop It is useful, but if they could have get a quick response, like within a 5 or 10 minutes, a staff would come to the next station, you know, to solve the issue, it will be much more effective for them.
You're listening to Dr. Romana Sarkar, who's a research fellow at the Transport Research Group at Monash University. We're talking about safety in public transport if you've used the Stop It text line. What do you believe, Romana, would be the best way of making sure that women are safe? Is it this sort of text line? Is it when you talk about getting that action, is that, do you believe, should be worked into the text line system?
I think one of the disadvantage that this app now has at the moment is this non-live, it's not live monitored. Mm. So people, the women, they have this perception that even if I text there, maybe I will not get response as quickly as I want or as quickly as I need it. So in our survey, actually, we asked about some technological implementation, like using a button app where users can actually get a quick response within 5 to 10 minutes. So the users, they...
Isn't an app that's available at the moment?
No, this is not. This is a hypothetical app that we asked because, and we also asked, like, within how many minutes would they like to get those responses? So it was around 5 to 10 minutes. Mm. And so when we asked about why they have not used Stop It, we frequently got that answer that they don't think that they will get the right services, like the efficiency is a problem. But having that app, like Stop It messaging, is useful for the perception that yes. Yeah, if I need something, I will get to call someone or text someone.
Yeah, and establish what shouldn't be put up with in the first place. Romana, thank you so much for joining the conversation today.
Yeah, thank you.
Dr. Romana Sarkar from Monash University. Have you used the Stop It line? And yes, I will repeat that line because people are asking about it. It is, and I have now just lost it, 0499 455 455. People are telling me I've just missed it. It's all over the bus stops. Others are saying I've just read about it in today's paper and I'm putting it in my phone now. And it's such a quick message on the trams, says this person. No way to note the number or details. Needs a bit better marketing. Tell me about what you believe when it comes to Stop It. Is that what we need? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. But also I'm asking you, how do you make connections in later life? Maybe it's volunteering. We're going to be talking volunteers, celebrating them because it's National Volunteer Week. But also coming up next, a new program that puts international students in touch with older Melburnians.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
How do we make connections in later life? 1300 222 774. Tell me your story. I'd love to hear from you. We're going to be talking about making connections across international student, older person cohort, and also maybe volunteering is the way that you have made connections. Sally in Ferntree Gully, what's been your experience?
Oh, hi. Look, this isn't with students, but my husband and I About 5 years ago, we were lucky enough to hear about a local Probus Club through other friends who had been going there. And every time I spoke to them, they were doing something, they were having fun, and they'd made lots of friends. So we joined up, and it's been absolutely fabulous.
Oh, terrific.
It really is. The idea of Probus, it's part of the thing, is friendship and fellowship. And that's exactly what we've got. Lots of activities every month, walking every Tuesday. We call it coffee strollers, and we talk, walk for half an hour and sit in a cafe and talk over coffee.
Oh, that's fantastic. Sally, how long have you been in it?
I think it's 6 years now that we've been members.
Oh, terrific. And lots of friends out of it?
Yes, definitely. And it's great for men as well. My husband, they have a men's brunch once a month, and the men now, when we have a meeting, they all just gravitate to each other and they gossip just as much as the women.
Of course.
He's having a great time as well. He's made some really good friends as well.
Of course, and as we know, men sometimes need it more than women. Sally, thank you so much for joining the conversation. I'm joined in the studio with Kevin Shee, who's an international student who's behind this program, and also Kay Oak, who is involved in this program called Being Melburnian. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin, you came up with the idea of combining international students, connecting international students with senior people. Why? What was it in your life that made you do that?
So when I was a first-year student at the University of Melbourne, I found that I really want to know more about Australian culture and meet with local people. And then I do volunteering at the neighborhood center, North and West Melbourne Neighborhood Center. Mm-hmm. And I met a variety of local seniors who are very, very generous and kind. They are super lovely people. And they told me a lot about Australian culture, how to pronounce Australian slangs.
And meeting them gave you the idea that essentially these are two groups that are a little bit isolated.
Yes, yes. For me, as an international student, I want to engage with local people so that I can feel more a sense of belonging in Melbourne. And in engaging with locals and local seniors, mm-hmm. Really helped me to feel supported and feel welcomed by the local community. And I think that that's what in my mind that I probably can help other internet students to connect with local people. Yeah. And that's how I come up with this Being Melburnian program.
Kevin, you've mentioned the North and West Melbourne Neighbourhood Centre, and connected with that centre is you, Kay. You've done many amazing things in your life. Just to remind people, you were awarded a Medal of the Order of Australia for all of your work in service to the community in the IVF sector. You're part of this centre as well. Tell me about your involvement in this and what you think that the senior Melburnians are getting out of it.
Well, I suppose there's a variety of senior Melburnians. It's senior North Melburnians in particular, because we're operating through the North Melbourne Community Centre. I think it's showing North Melbourne to other people and to people who are new in the area, and sharing our enthusiasm for the area, but also sharing the culture of what is essential to North Melbourne.
So it's connecting North Melbourne in particular with University of Melbourne students. It's been a pilot and now has been given a life for two more years. What are the sort of things that people end up going to do?
There's a variety of things. I mean, apart from there'd been general sort of meetings and discussion groups about what is culture in Melbourne, but people have gone for picnics, gone off to see kangaroos in places, gone to the football, and I think that was a big one, the learning about football, and I suppose the local oldies explaining all these funny terms that happen in football itself.
Is this just a sneaky way of recruiting more people to go for North Melbourne? North Melbourne?
It was North Melbourne Women's Group too that the people going, but of course they need all the support they can get.
Yeah. And so what's the sort of reactions that you hear from the senior people, aged people, what aged people? What senior people? I don't even like senior as an adjective.
Oldies.
Older people?
Oldies.
Oldies. Oldies. Just do it. What's been the reaction from them?
I think it's been very positive and very... I mean, people want to do something to help people in the area and get to know the area. So I think that... and it's broadened people out because it's so easy to explain things to other people. If you're taking them, go for a coffee and explain, look, this is how we do things here. This is what, as Kevin would say, this is what a meat pie is.
is that what you learned, Kevin?
Yeah. So I would say golden Melbournians, right? The old Melbournians, so they're golden. It's their golden age. They're full of life experience. They're full of knowledge. And they can provide, as a young person, they can provide me a lot of knowledge. Not just about culture, it's also about my life, navigate this new life in Melbourne and how to find a job in Melbourne. So that's all kind of knowledge, life experience that I really want to learn from a person who lived in Melbourne for 50 years.
Yeah, and so that sense of involvement that you were looking for, that you were talking about, you feel that now?
Yes. Like just moments ago, Kay just taught me how to perform well in radio in a radio interview. So yeah,
she's taught you well. this is fantastic. So now we've got the funding. How big will this get?
Oh, right. So City Melbourne invested like $12,000 to run the Being in Melbourne program for the next 2 years. So from July 2006.
Would you like to see it go beyond Melbourne University and North Melbourne?
Yes. The idea is actually we want to expand this model to other neighborhood centers and including other universities as well, not just University of Melbourne, but also RMIT University. Victoria University and the Monash University.
That's the plan.
Yes.
Well, good luck with everything. Really appreciate you coming into the studio and, best of luck.
Thank you.
Learn about those meat pies and you've nailed the radio. Kevin Shee, you've been listening to, and Kay Oak as well, and we've been talking about the Being Melburnian program that's reducing isolation and loneliness. Maybe that's... an idea for all of us, but also what we have is the ability to volunteer. That's how many people reach out and get their connections in later life. Is that what you've done? Next, we'll talk about the wonderful benefits of being a volunteer.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Are you a volunteer? Tell me your great volunteer stories. Is that how you have made connections in older life? Apparently, almost 10 million of us are volunteering, either formally or informally or both. Mark Pearce is CEO of Volunteering Australia as he kicks off National Volunteer Week. Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm very well. Good morning.
Almost 10 million. I must admit, I was a little surprised.
Yeah, 9.5 million Australians volunteer, as you say, through organisations, outside of organisations, or both. And it is a remarkable number. I mean, when you look at that in the lens of, perhaps productivity terms, the national paid workforce is about 13.3 million people. So this is a huge number of Australians who have a commitment to community and engage with community each and every day.
And how does it work in these really tough times with lots of, not just cost of living, but the cost of getting around with the fuel crisis? Has that bumped the numbers down at all?
Well, this is a really interesting question. And I think as you expressed a bit of surprise around that, the size of that number, the quantum of that number, we were a bit surprised when the the General Social Survey came out just a couple of weeks ago, because what that told us was that despite a whole lot of impediments, despite some of the breaks, things like cost of living and other things, the volunteering has held up really well. It's been robust. And despite those constraints. The other interesting thing about that is that whilst numbers of volunteers has been pretty stable from about 2020 to 2025, the hours given by volunteers has gone up, and it's gone up really materially by about 128 million hours in 2025.
What's the theory there, Matt?
Well, there are a couple of things. I think it illustrates this ongoing deep commitment to community that people feel within themselves, and they're keen to engage, not just for community's sake, but of course, volunteering brings so many individual benefits. But it also reflects upon a growing and increasing need within community for support. So, yes, it's wonderful to see people volunteering. It's wonderful for people to be giving more hours of their limited time. But it also reflects the fact that there is a growing need within community which isn't otherwise being met, and volunteers step in to provide support within community for that.
Mm. You're listening to Mark Pearce, who's CEO of Volunteering Australia. Mark, we've been talking today about making connections in later life. Do you find that that is a big motivating factor for volunteering, or does it come the other way around? Volunteering just gives you those connections after you've been inspired to start?
It's a little bit of both, as you would probably expect. And I was really heartened to hear the stories just before I came on, talking about that opportunity to connect, that reduction in the feeling of isolation or, that being apart from community. Volunteering provides people with the opportunity to both identify who their community is or where their community is, because community is both geographic, but it's also interest-based. And volunteering provides people with an opportunity to get involved in those sorts of things, to make the connections. And we know that the data tells us that when people volunteer, their well-being increases. And to give some example of that, during COVID, as we all know, and certainly Victoria felt this acutely, where there were such extended lockdowns, 2 in every 3 volunteers had to stop volunteering altogether. And we did some research with the Australian National University to try and understand what effect that had, both within community, but for individuals as well. Mm. And one of the really striking things that came from that was that for those people who were able to continue to volunteer during those periods of lockdown, their mental health, their well-being was materially better than those who had to stop. Mm. And that tells us something really important about connection.
Mark, I thought it was interesting that the United Nations has made this the International Year of Volunteers for Sustainable Development. When you talk about the interests that drive people to volunteer, how much does, you know, the environment, the health of the planet rely on volunteers?
It really relies very heavily upon the engagement and involvement of volunteers. And I think that this, I mean, volunteering is great for a whole lot of reasons, but one of the things that it does is that it provides some agency to people who might otherwise feel somewhat helpless in an environment that moves fast, and you don't tend to feel like you've got a lot of control. People get involved in volunteering for a whole lot of reasons, but when it comes to things like environment and sustainability, and we read about this and we feel it each and every day, people who get involved in the sustainability of the planet, in protecting the environment, feel deeply connected to being part of the solution rather than the victims of something which is desperately out of control. And I think that that's a big motivating factor. We see it across all age groups and all cohorts, but we also know that young people are deeply involved in those volunteering engagements which involve sustainability, which involve environment and the betterment of community.
This on text, volunteer with Emerald Fire Brigade, great people. Of course, we rely so much on volunteers for that. Marita is volunteering end-of-life support in the community. Wonderful to be able to give back. Mark, are there any sectors that need more volunteers? Oh, I guess everyone needs more volunteers, but anything in particular you would be putting on people's radar that they might not be thinking about?
Look, I think healthcare is always one of those areas. Aged care is another, and we were talking about end-of-life care, and it's such a critically important piece. It's when you look at where volunteering takes place in every aspect of human engagement each and every day. But there are opportunities, irrespective of your interest and irrespective of your geography. But certainly healthcare is one of those places. Mm-hmm. Things like, for example, food support, education, and of course, environment, sustainability. But even that piece which sits around, and just thinking about your the former discussion that you just had around community connection, always opportunities for people to get more involved in that. And there's always demand for people to put up their hand and get involved in creating those community connections.
Indeed, doing something for yourself as well as others. Mark Pearce, thank you for joining us today.
It's indeed my pleasure.
Mark Pearce is CEO of Volunteering Australia. We are talking about connecting with people, whether it be through international students, connecting with older Melburnians. Raima, you've called from Riddles Creek. Do you volunteer?
Yes, I do.
Where do you go?
I volunteer for Riding for the Disabled in Oaklands, Victoria.
Horse riding?
Horse riding, yes. And we have school students and some older adults on the weekend. School children, they come from various special schools around the area. We have two sessions a day, and it's just, and I've made lots of really good friends there, but we also to see what the children get out of this. A lot of them have very poor balance, and by horse riding they gain core strength and balance with the horses, and they also get, and it's just wonderful seeing the joy they get out of it.
So that you have obviously would agree with Mark Pearce that we just heard from about that sense of well-being, that's really rebounded back on you?
Yes, for sure, but it's just seeing what the children get from it, and unfortunately we don't have enough volunteers. We could help many more children, but we don't have the volunteers to help.
That sounds like a good call out, Raima. Thank you. Raima, thank you so much for calling in. Kevin, you've called in from Sandringham. What did you want to say?
Yeah, Kevin from Sandringham. Yeah, look, I'm a retired Catholic priest. I joined the social justice group in the parish here, but also join neighbourhood watch, because it's a way of meeting people and doing my little bit in the community.
Neighbourhood watch? Are they still around, Kevin? I should look around my neighbourhood.
Yeah, they do a very good brochure around here, and so we deliver it, and they have all sorts of things, morning teas with the police, and
And you get something out of it, Kevin?
Yeah, I certainly do. Yeah.
Yeah. Kevin, thank you so much for calling in. Also, you've been texting in about meeting loads of international students through my daughter who's still at university, says this texter. It became quite clear that many of them are quite lonely and live in tiny shoebox apartments at exorbitant rents. Goes on to say that helping those international students has been a really rewarding experience for them. Tell me your stories of connection. A little later this hour, we'll be talking about, well, how worried should we be about an Ebola outbreak that's been classed as an international emergency. We will get to that. But next, let's talk about what happens in a captain's mind in the cockpit when passengers in a plane go rogue.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, you might have seen a story overnight about an unruly passenger who was so unruly that they had to make the plane land on their way from Melbourne to Dallas. They had to go to Tahiti. And, yeah, it was serious. And, in fact, there were allegations of biting. Now, what does a captain do in these circumstances? How can a pilot running that ship actually respond? I'm joined now by Michelle Huntington, former airline captain who's had lots of experiences in her two decades flying, but especially with violent and unruly passengers. Thanks for joining us, Michelle.
Hi, Mary.
Do you read these news stories and think, I know that?
Yeah. I watched the, it's on YouTube at the moment, that video going around about that flight on the weekend. And the cabin crew did a textbook job, like even the way that they were holding the passenger, everything they did. It was great.
So obviously you're the pilot, you're relying on that cabin crew to do, you know, as you say, carry out their training. At what point are you alerted that something is happening if you're the pilot?
Pretty soon when it happens. So the cabin supervisor or cabin manager are the captain's eyes and ears in the cabin. And anything that's slightly unusual that could escalate, they let the captain know pretty well straight away.
Mm. How much training do you as a pilot and also the cabin crew get when it comes to handling those situations?
At Virgin, we, the cabin crew and the pilots trained together. We do at least once a year on security training with the emphasis on, you know, keeping the aircraft safe. Mm. So, and its passengers for whatever happens. So the, yeah, as I said, the cabin crew, it was textbook. It was exactly like in the training. They did it so well.
You're listening to Michelle Huntington, who's a former airline captain. We're talking about how the crew does respond when it is an unruly passenger on board. Tell me about your stories if you have anything to share. 1300 222 774 is the number to call for that. Michelle, you not only have to, as a pilot, make sure that everyone is safe, as you say, but also calm. How do you do that?
Yeah, the cabin crew are trained to de-escalate. So that's, we don't know what's going on in the passenger's mind. So there could be inebriated from alcohol or drugs. There could be a medical condition and a mental health condition and or a mental health condition. So they don't know what they're dealing with. Passengers rarely tell you. So it's just humans in, you know, and especially the fact that they're in an aluminium tube at altitude. They can't get out and they can't seek the advice of others necessarily. So their number one thing is to de-escalate using words and just calming, soothing tones, etc.
Mm. Is something you've experienced then? How yeah. often would it happen?
Oh, thankfully not that often. I only had it happen something similar about three times in my career in my 20-odd years. So, yeah, I was fortunate, well-behaved passengers. But when it happens, you spring into action. We have, you know, there are definitely procedures around it. Everyone knows what to do. It's a well-oiled machine.
Any advice for people who are witnessing something like that?
Yeah, just know that the cabin crew or the whole crew are trained in this. It's because it is at altitude, it's in an environment where you can't call on others necessarily. Mm. They are trained so well. Their number one concern is to keep every passenger safe. So if they need to handcuff someone, they'll do it. But it's a big call.
Yeah, that is. Listen to the crew. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Mary.
Michelle Huntington is a former airline captain. Tell me if you've had stories like that. Also, we've been talking about volunteering and how we make connections, particularly in later life. We're celebrating volunteers today. It's National Volunteer Week. Sandy in Dalesford, do you volunteer?
I certainly do, Mary. I've been the president for the last 3 years of a Friday community lunch club that me and a group of fabulous volunteers run, and we've actually been operating for 14 years now.
Oh, true. How many people do you give lunch to?
Yes, well, it changes each week, but between 35 and 40. And
fantastic.
It's not mandatory, but we ask for a small donation. And, I mean, it's just the most gorgeous, eclectic group of people that come along. And I think since the COVID period, it really has morphed into a very much a social hub. And, I mean, people don't generally realise, but there's an awful lot of unfortunate people living in this community. It's, you know, usually seen as something that's more upmarket. But
yeah, what's the name of it again, Sandy?
It's called the 5,000 Club, which originally was a reference to feeding the 5,000.
Sandy.
And the other thing, Mary, is that I also belong to the Dalesford Table Tennis Club.
Oh.
I totally love being part of
it. Keeps you fit. That is fantastic, and maybe clubs are just definitely the way to keep those connections going if you're volunteering or if you're playing table tennis. Thank you, Sandy. And you've called in from Port Arlington. Do you volunteer?
I do volunteer. I'm involved in quite a few activities, but one of the really exciting things I've just been involved in is conducting a community survey to find out what people in Port Arlington love about the place. And people come here because they, you know, they love our beachside rural environment. But then once they get here, what they really love is being involved in all of the clubs and activities. And there are so many clubs and activities because people volunteer. So the volunteering gives the people who volunteer a sense of worthiness.
Mm.
But then people who come from everywhere to live here, but they're outside their usual social structures, when they get here, they find that by being involved in those clubs run by volunteers gives them a sense of belonging. So I both volunteer, but I'm also involved in many of the clubs and groups, and it's just a wonderful village feeling of connectedness.
Yeah, perpetuates that feeling. And good on you. Good on you for all of your work. And thank you for telling us your story. So many animals finding a better life because of those folks who foster animals to find a forever home. That texter wanted to shout out all of those. Peter is saying, 28 years volunteering with the CFA. It's been great, and we need more young people. And so many more texts coming in. We will continue our conversation about volunteers, but also we wanted to have a little look. Australia is going to be responding with the rest of the world to an international emergency that's just been called, connected to Ebola. How worried should we be?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
No one's ever been diagnosed with Ebola virus disease in Australia, according to the Centre for Disease Control, but that doesn't mean that we're off the hook. It's an international emergency now, an Ebola outbreak in the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Uganda. So what do we need to do here in Australia? Professor Paul Griffin is Director of Infectious Diseases at Queensland University. Thanks for joining us, Paul.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
What do you think about this outbreak and what makes it dangerous?
Okay, it certainly is a situation that's concerning and appropriate for the WHO to declare a public health emergency of international concern, and mostly because of the number of challenges being faced in that area. I mean, we know that there's conflict and poor resources, etc., and we've already had a very high number of cases reported, but the true magnitude is likely far greater. So this declaration enables there to be a coordinated response across many countries to be able to make sure that this does remain geographically contained in that area and that it is limited in terms of its ability to spread further.
Stats so far are terrible. 88 deaths, more than 300 suspected cases. But as you say, there are some challenges when it comes to even getting across those. Mark, can you explain, give us a little quick explainer as to what Ebola virus is and what this particular strain of this virus is and how dangerous it is?
Yeah, absolutely. So Ebola is not a new virus discovered in the late 70s, and there's three or four main strains. This is one that we haven't seen outbreaks quite as much so far. It does have a slightly lower mortality than the others, but still very high at around 25 to 50%. And one of the main challenges with this particular type is we have no vaccine or therapy. There's a vaccine for the other more dominant strain, but there isn't anything for this one. But I do want to reassure people that while it has a very high mortality and there's a large number of cases so far, so it makes sense to make this declaration, it's not something that's easy to spread. So we're not talking about pandemic potential or that we expect cases outside of that area. We just want to make sure we do limit how many cases there are and provide the best support for that area to get this under control.
Mm-hmm. It's 10 minutes to 12. We're talking about the Ebola outbreak that's been declared an international community here on The Conversation Hour. Are you listening to Professor Paul Griffin? He's from Queensland University. Paul, as I said, no one's ever been diagnosed with it here in Australia. So would you expect that in terms of it coming here, we're pretty safe?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this declaration is not that we expect there to be cases outside of that region, but it is certainly to contain it and get it back under control. One of the other big differences with something that's much more severe than a respiratory virus is that often people that get this are quite unwell. They're unlikely to be able to move around and certainly unable to move around without it being obvious that they're unwell. So it's not something that's expected to spread, and so we certainly don't expect that we're going to see it here. But what it does require is a really coordinated effort to get some basic resources to the regions to identify how big an issue it is now and to try and manage any cases that are there appropriately.
What about any Australians who are travelling to the area?
I'd certainly be cautious if you're going right to those regions where it is around at the moment. So certainly there's three main areas in the DRC and a smaller area in Uganda where we've seen cases so far. So if you do, for whatever reason, have to travel to those specific areas, it would be something to certainly be aware of and take some simple precautions. Outside of that, people don't necessarily need to be concerned about this particular issue. But obviously, whenever you're travelling, make sure you pay attention to the relevant advice for that area.
Mm. Paul, I don't know if this is putting you on the spot, but how much of an effect did the canning of the USAID program contribute to this either, or in the absence of it now, as we know, President Trump in his administration has taken a lot of support away from that area. Would that have exacerbated what we might be seeing now, or our response to it has been lessened because of that?
It's hard to know if there's a direct effect on this particular issue, but we know that these sort of issues are arising more frequently. We've obviously not even finished talking about hantavirus, and now we're talking about Ebola outbreaks. And so we know that these issues do arise more frequently these days for a whole host of reasons, and what is required and why the public health emergency of international concern has been declared is we need cooperation across the world, basically, to make sure there are appropriate resources and expertise applied to wherever these issues may be. So defunding those sort of public health measures in any part of the world potentially leaves us vulnerable and less able to respond. So, you know, it's great that Australia isn't in that same predicament, and we have an excellent public health system and a CDC here that can hopefully provide some assistance if required.
Paul, thank you so much for giving us a little bit of an explainer on it today.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Professor Paul Griffin is Director of Infectious Diseases at Queensland University. It's 7 minutes to 12 on the Conversation Hour. We've been talking about connections later in life, international students and senior Australians getting together, oldies, as we heard before. I've been asking you your stories. This on text, I'm a grandmother and volunteer at the school lunch canteen. And so many more. The local university of the third age group, that's been getting a couple of mentions as well. Also, a sector that actually relies so much on volunteers is the charity area. And Daniel Moorfield is the CEO of Second Bite, which is one of Australia's largest food relief programs, and joins me now. Hi, Daniel. How much do you rely on volunteers?
Yeah, no, a lot. So we've got over 1,200 volunteers across Australia, and then in Victoria alone, there's about 800 volunteers in our kitchens and in our farms.
You, how many paid staff versus volunteers? Like, how much are you relying on them?
Well, put it this way, we've got 160 paid staff and over 1,200 volunteers, so it makes such a difference. Our kitchens in particular, we would have 30 volunteers each day in the kitchen with only about 5 or 6 paid staff, and some of our volunteers have been working there for 20 years.
Yeah. You've said that, of course, a lot of your volunteers as well are struggling because of the fuel costs as well, and your clients.
Yeah, what we see at the moment, unfortunately, is the need for food out there is so high. A lot of people, unfortunately, are choosing between fuel, food and rent. And when they have that choice, usually it's food that misses out, unfortunately. So yeah. Anything that can be done to get food for people, that's so critical right now, which is so having the volunteers who not only come up and produce the food for people, but they can feel good about supporting all those people in need right now.
Daniel, can you paint a picture of what it looks like right now there in the kitchen?
I was hectic, absolutely hectic. We've got, about 30 volunteers all cooking meals right now. Today we'll produce about 6,000 meals. And this is things like we're doing sausages with rice. And so sausages, vegetable with rice. And it's the hub, like the lots of noise, lots of chatter, everything.
I can almost smell it from here. Daniel, CEO of Second Bite, just really quickly, how can people volunteer?
Just get onto our website. So look at our Second Bite website or Fair Share website, and you can have the opportunities, either of those, to volunteer at our garden, farm, or in our kitchen. We'd love to have you.
There you go. You've heard him, Daniel Moorfield. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Daniel Moorfield is the CEO of Second Bite. Trish in Heathmont, you're a volunteer, is that right?
I am, yes. I actually live in Montrose. I'm out at the moment.
Oh, okay.
So in the Yarra Valley. The organisation I volunteer for is called the Yarra Valley Winter Shelter, and it's part of Stable One, which is a network of organisations, churches, offering accommodation for homeless and at-risk people. It's overnight accommodation, so the guests come in for a warm meal, some companionship, and a warm and safe place to sleep overnight.
And Trish, what do you do there? What?
I'm the sous chef.
Ah, okay.
I help out in the kitchen, so there are two volunteers in the kitchen. They might both be cooks, but I'm not a cook, so I work with
them. Hey, you're a sous chef, you can call yourself that. Trish, what do you get out of volunteering?
I get a lot of joy. I know that I'm doing what God wants me to do and I'm where He intends me to be. And the ability to pass on the need for volunteers to the wider public.
Trish, thank you. Good on you for all of your work. And this on text, volunteering's all positive. Forget dating apps. If you want to meet quality people, use volunteering. Thanks for joining me on the Conversation Hour. Write to me, conversationhour@abc.net.au.